Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG Talks. I'm Pradeep Mundra here, and I'm your host for today. Now, fecal microbiome is probably one of the most complex concepts to understand, at least for my simple mind. And estimates indicate that there's probably about 30 trillion bacterial cells in the body, which is equivalent to the number of cells that we have. And the variety of them probably explains why it is so difficult to understand the role of microbiome in health and disease. And I guess imbalance seems to be implicated in almost all of disease and health states. And sometimes, at least in some disease states, I wonder whether this is more of a chicken and egg situation where does the imbalance in microbiome leads to disease or the disease leads to the imbalance in microbiome. Fecal microbiota transplant, or let's call it that way for now at least, involves transfer of stools from a healthy individual to an individual with disease. And I guess with an intention to reset the microbiome with an aim to treat the disease process. Considering every other day there's a new paper published about implicating the role of gut microbiome in disease states, I feel that fecal microbiota transplant may have a very expanding role in treating various diseases in the future. But where do we stand currently in this year? To discuss this today, we have our lovely guest, Professor Maria Verschild, who's an infectious diseases specialist and head of infectious diseases department at Frankfurt University Hospital in Germany. Maria has published extensively in this field and heads the Cologne Microbiota Bank and has also taught previously at the PGT program at UEG Week. Welcome to the podcast, Maria.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
Excellent. So, Maria, I remember a story a few years ago about German troops in World War II in Africa eating camel poo to treat traveler's dysentery. The way I remember it is I think they followed what the locals said, locals used to do. But surely the concept of fecal microbiota transplant goes before this. Can you tell us when it all started and who conceptualized this?
Yeah, to my knowledge, it was first described in ancient China as yellow soup. That's what I learned is the earliest description of something similar to a fecal microbiota transfer. What's maybe important for us as modern physicians is that the first formal case description was published in the 1950s by Mr. I think his name was Steinman, from Colorado. And after that, FMT was used in case series, particularly in the Scandinavian countries. And then in 2013, we had the first randomized controlled trial, which was conducted in the Netherlands. And I think everybody is very much aware of the impact of this trial and how it changed our view on FMT, or how it even drew the attention of people to this topic who were previously not even aware of the existence of FMT.
At the beginning, was it the same indication that it was used, or was it for a completely different, let's say, in the 1950s?
The physician who used it initially, he did not really understand exactly why his patients were suffering from diarrhea. So he thought that there was a different cause, and it only later became clear that C. diff is actually the cause of this problem. But he did use it for hospital-acquired diarrhea.
Okay. So that indication still kind of stands. That brings us on to the next topic, Maria. Can you explain in simple terms how a complex concussion of unknown bacteria and totally unknown substrates, I'm assuming, could work in a specifically defined disease state such as C. difficile? I guess IBD is a different ballgame, and its etiology is extremely complex and unknown. So what's the pathophysiology behind the mechanism of action of fecal microbiota transplant?
So my interpretation of the evidence is that when people are exposed to antibiotics, their physiological composition of the microbiota is altered, and the physiological microbiota is able to downregulate the transformation from C. diff spores into vegetative cells, but also the toxin production. And now there are different hypotheses how this works. One very much discussed hypothesis is that primary bile acids are converted into secondary bile acids by components of the physiological microbiota. And that if I then expose my patient to antibiotics, these bacteria that manage this transformation, they are gone. And then the feedback mechanism that stops the Clostridia from multiplying and producing toxin is also gone. And then they become active, and our asymptomatic carrier then turns into a symptomatic patient. Some people doubt this hypothesis. And other mechanisms have also been discussed. For example, phages might play a role in regulating the composition of the bacteria in the gut. Then it has been hypothesized that other metabolites may also play an important role. But I think it's safe to say that the regulation of the activity of C. diff is somehow connected to the composition of our gut microbiota.
And how would FMT change that in terms of how would it work in patients with C. diff?
Yeah, so if your gut microbiota composition is disturbed and you are lacking the bacteria that you need to suppress the C. diff activity, then FMT will restore a physiological habitat in your gut and reestablish the regulation processes to suppress CDI.
And in C. diff, I guess as a physician, you know, my aim when I treat these patients is to improve the symptoms and probably, you know, prevent mortality. Although I personally haven't come across anyone who, or any of my patients die from C. diff, but I've dealt with pretty sick elderly patients with C. diff. I'm assuming the goals of treatment is to kind of improve their symptoms and reduce mortality. You know, in terms of current drug management, what is lacking with the current use of drugs? Why was there a need to use FMT for such patients?
Yeah, so we know that when patients are treated with metronidazole or vancomycin, the recurrence rate after having treated the first episode is around 25%. It's lower if they are treated with fidaxomicin, but there still is a considerable recurrence rate. And then some patients do enter a kind of vicious cycle of recurrences. And FMT, in my opinion, is particularly important for these patients who do not respond anymore to any of these drugs. Or better put, they do respond, but as soon as you stop the treatment, they will have another recurrency, no matter which drug you use. And these patients really need their microbiota restored to prevent further recurrencies.
So that you've already mentioned, looks like that's one of the indication for use of FMT in C. diff in terms of preventing recurrence. And can you just allude to, you know, what are the current indications in C. diff for the whole scheme of C. diff management? Where can we use FMT? Only in recurrence patients? Can we use it as a primary treatment instead of antibiotics? How does this fit in and amongst various drugs, you know, vancomycin, metronidazole, fidaxomicin? So where do we need to consider FMT in our patients?
Yeah, so current guidelines recommend an FMT as a follow-up treatment to a standard treatment. I want to explain this well, because I think many people are not aware of the fact that the idea is not to treat diarrhea, a current diarrhea episode with an FMT. What people usually do is that they treat the current episode with one of the standard drugs, and then when that is finished and patients are free of symptoms, they perform the FMT to stabilize the situation. But it's not done interchangeably or at the same time, it's sequentially. So that's important to understand. So it's really a secondary prophylaxis. that's the proper classification for the FMT. And you were asking, when is this done? At an international level, guidelines recommend FMT for multiple recurrent CDI. So that means you need at least 2 recurrences, otherwise it's not multiple. But there are trials that are trying to get closer to treating earlier. So this is definitely where things are going. But guidelines are not there to recommend that already. And there definitely isn't enough evidence yet to say after a primary episode, we should perform an FMT in everybody. We are not there yet, but I know that people are thinking into this direction.
Okay, so just let me make it clear to our listeners. 2 recurrences means you get a primary episode of C. diff, you get your first recurrence, you get your second recurrence. So that's the 3rd time they are having a C. diff episode with, you know, investigations confirming positive C. diff. That's when you would use, but you also mentioned that that's when you treat them and then use FMT to prevent. Am I correct in that?
That's correct, yeah.
Excellent. Okay. And the treatment for that, you would always use these antibiotics, the vancomycin at that time or fidaxomicin?
Personally, prefer to use fidaxomicin because it causes less collateral damage to the gut microbiota. And as I just explained, it's all about restoring the gut microbiota. So I actually don't want to cause any further collateral damage if I can prior to the FMT. On the other hand, you can say, well, if you're just going to restore it radically anyway, you can also use vancomycin. So I think both works. And it's often more an economical question than really a medical question whether one or the other is used.
Right. Is that a universal rule about the second recurrence? Are there any selected patients you do not want to use FMT, depending on the immune status?
Oh, do you mean are there contraindications? Yeah, I mean, there are definitely patients where the risks associated with an FMT are higher than in others. So whenever there's significant disturbance of the barrier function of the gut, then I would be very careful when I perform an FMT. For example, let's say I have a neutropenic patient who has received chemotherapy and there's also inflammatory activity due to the chemotherapy in the gut mucosa, then this is a patient I have to watch very closely when I perform an FMT. I'm not saying you cannot perform it, but you do have to be more careful. There is a clinical trial in steroid refractory graft versus host disease after stem cell transplantation that proves that it is possible to administer FMTs in quite extreme situation with respect to immunosuppression. But of course, these patients have to be watched closely.
Okay. So, Maria, it looks like with C. diff, it's reasonably clear when we should use. And in my practice as a gastroenterologist, we mainly deal with IBD patients. And most of my IBD patients, a lot of my IBD patients ask about FMT. In fact, one of my patients a few years ago, I remember he asked me about FMT. And I said, well, there's some evidence, but the guidelines do not suggest using FMT out with the clinical trials. And he went home and said, oh, he got some poo from his relative, made it into an enema concussion and administered it himself. So there are some people who just strongly believe in this. So I guess I just want you to sort of summarize what's the current evidence for use of FMT in IBD. And I guess what I'm getting at is, am I okay to advise using it right now or should we wait for more evidence to emerge?
That's a very good and a very difficult to answer question. So I believe it's safe to say that FMT, generally spoken, has a favorable effect on IBD, but it's very difficult to say in which situation it should be used in which way. So let me try to explain that further. So we now have a moderate number of randomized controlled trials. They are moderate in size or small, so that doesn't help. We would actually like a very big trial better. And if you look at the meta-analyses that are performed based on these trials, there is an effect, a favorable effect of FMT on the activity of the IBD. But these trials have been performed in very different ways. So some trials have used multiple donors to produce an FMT. Others used just one donor per treatment. Others used anaerobic conditions for manufacturing the FMT. Yet others treated very intensively over longer periods of time. Others only once. Some used capsules. Some administered the FMT endoscopically. Some used an antibiotic induction treatment prior to FMT. And some used additional nutritional preparations, like a nutrition regimen in combination with the FMT. So there are so many factors that might have determined the favorable outcome that it's really hard to say how should the perfect FMT in this setting look like and how long should this be administered? Because many of the trials also show if there is an effect, it wanes after a certain time. And we need to keep that in mind too, because it means I would have to re-administer the FMT again and again. So it's not a question of if, but how to do this. And I see that this can be really frustrating for the patients that we say, oh yeah, there is an effect. I still cannot give it to you because I'm not sure what's the best way to give it to you.
So the way I interpret what you're trying to get at is at this stage, as a clinician, it's difficult or I can't really be justified in using this outside a trial setting. Maybe on an individual basis, you can make that decision, explaining the uncertainty to the patients. Is that what your thoughts are?
Yes, I can give you an example. When the first trials came out that showed a certain effect, we treated around 10 patients here in Germany, because based on our laws, we can do that. But then we realized that this is more complicated than we may have thought, because we then also realized that when people responded, the effect went away after about 3 months, and that we would have to re-invite these people probably every 3 months to receive these treatments. At the same time, we don't have financial compensation of these treatments in Germany. So who would pay for this? And how is it ethically fair to give this to 10 people, but not to all the others? So we stopped it again and decided that we should really wait for the situation to be much clearer and for the possibility to scale up the production with financial safety before we would offer this to more people.
Are there any large studies going on at the moment which would change the scene, so to say, for our IBD patients?
There are many studies going on, but what I'm missing a bit is a very large trial that would systematically assess all the different, or at least some of the different factors that might be meaningful here. But I understand the funding landscape also. It's extremely difficult to get money for such a big trial, but it's less difficult to get money for a small or moderate sized trial. So we get all these small or moderate sized trials, but we cannot answer the big questions.
Right. Okay. So looks like a bit of a way to go for this. Okay. Let's move on to the next one, IBS. Always difficult. And we as clinicians really struggle to treat patients. Certainly in the clinical practice, I'm always advising patients to try different probiotics, let's say. And when my patients ask me, oh, which one to try? A lot of times I'm clueless, I have to say, and kind of say, oh, try different things, whichever works for you. So I'm assuming, you know, giving a concussion of bacteria seems to help some of our patients. So my question is, you know, would FMT work for such patients? And who should we be considering? Or what does the science say?
So the science says you should not offer it at this point, because again, there is a number of trials that looked into this indication. And if you take the meta-analyses that are quite recent, you do not see a benefit for FMT overall. But we must also recognize that these, of course, statistical assessments of many patients, and that we see is a kind of average. It's not exactly an average, but I think you understand what I mean. Yet, from my practical experience, there are individual patients that seem to benefit from the FMT, but I cannot exclude that they benefit from it because of the placebo effect. So, because when I offer it in an individualized trial setting, I cannot use a placebo, so I cannot be sure why these people benefited. And also here, I often see the effect that the effect wanes after about 2 or 3 months. And then you have the same problem as with the IBD people, how to deal with that on the long run.
Looks like, you know, people are thinking about different indications. Is there any other disease process that FMT been tried other than these three we discussed just now?
There is a very broad range of trials that's out there right now. So we have trials in the neurological area, on Parkinson's disease, on multiple sclerosis. We have trials in autoimmune diseases. There are trials in liver cirrhosis patients who are decompensated. There are trials in patients who are taking immune checkpoint inhibitors, and we want to enhance their response to these drugs. I think I could go on forever. Name the disease, it's very likely you will find a trial.
Okay, that's what I thought, you know, considering so much is published these days about, you know, microbiome changes in pretty much all disease process. So I'm not surprised that people are considering this for various disease process. Excellent. On that note, can you just move on to safety now? What can go wrong with these things? So can you highlight from your point of view, what could be the safety issues when we do FMT?
Yeah, sure. So the people who manufacture the FMT, they really need to take very good care in what they do. So it's very important that you have a stool bank that really concentrates on just manufacturing FMTs. These shouldn't be people who do this, I don't know, after their work or on the weekends. It should be a professional setup, really. And the professional setup includes roles of the different people who work in it. There needs to be a quality management and quality control system. All of this needs to be very professional, because there are a lot of potential safety risks. I like to compare it to a blood bank. Transfusions are nowadays quite sure, but they are quite sure because we learned that if we don't respect safety rules, we do have safety issues, and the same is true for FMT. So if you have set up such a system of quality management and quality control, I think it's a very safe treatment, but you really do have to guarantee that. And there is the EDQM guide that describes how substances of human origin should be processed if used as treatments. And this EDQM guide very clearly describes which quality standards are necessary to properly manufacture an FMT. So if anyone is interested to learn more about it, you can read that in the EDQM guide.
Okay. On that note, just to educate our listeners, what are the safety? Is it infections you're talking about, allergic reactions? What can go wrong?
Yeah. Okay. So in theory, potential pathogens could be transmitted to the recipient from the donor. And many healthy people are colonized by potential pathogens. For example, EHEC or EPEC. Many of us are intermittent carriers. We don't even notice it, but it wouldn't be very wise to have this transmitted to an immunocompromised patient through an FMT. I think we can agree on that. And we really have to check carefully for these things. So our safety process, or any safety process for an FMT, usually starts with an interview of the volunteer. And similar to an interview in a blood bank, risk behavior is asked for and prior underlying conditions. And then on the basis of that, it is decided whether the volunteer can give the stool bank some blood and feces that will then be checked for infectious diseases, pathogens. And then if that's also fine, the person can usually become a donor. But all these tests and questionnaires have to be repeated regularly.
So it is as rigid a process as a sort of blood transfusion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maria, can we move on to the routes of delivery? And we all have our thoughts on this. I guess the easiest would be for somebody to swallow a pill. So, you know, in terms of efficacy, in terms of what we should be using, let's say, you know, give an example of C. diff, what's your preferred method or route of delivery for this to be effective?
So let's start with the available ones. So you can go through the upper gastrointestinal tract. So the early trials, they used duodenal tubes through which the FMT was delivered. You could use capsules, as you just said. Then you could go through the lower gastrointestinal tract through colonoscopy or by use of an enema. And if you now look at the evidence, I would say that the enema is definitely not as efficacious as the other routes. Only if you use it repetitively, then they are similar. But if you only use it once, then the other routes are superior. Now, I don't really like to work with the tube because you have to place it endoscopically. And then also, if you have some kind of problem with aspiration, this can be dangerous if there's somehow a way that the infused microbiota comes back. We don't really want that. So I'd rather use capsules or a colonoscopy. That to me seems the safest way to do this. And between the two, the patients definitely prefer the capsules because then they don't need to have their guts prepared. They don't need the colonoscopy. And of course, a colonoscopy can also have side effects. And these can be spared if you use the capsule.
And the capsules are equally efficacious compared to colonoscopic method of delivery?
It's a bit difficult to say because there's no head-to-head trial, right? But if you look at studies that use capsules and studies that used colonoscopy, I would say maybe the evidence for colonoscopy is a couple of percentages better. But to me, that wouldn't really outweigh the advantages of the capsule. And the efficacy of the capsule is still very high with both methods. We are around 80% after one treatment.
So that brings on to the next point, Maria. How do you source, maybe where you work, can you get capsules? Can you get these pills with the FMT in Frankfurt? Where I work, I don't think so. I have access, as far as I know.
Yeah, so access is really different. When you look at different countries and regions of different countries, it differs radically. So as I understand, access in the UK is quite good. And there's also compensation by the insurance companies. This seems all very thought through and well set up. The same is true for Denmark. But then, for example, in Germany, we don't get recompensation for these treatments. And there are only very few centers who actually offer these treatments. And we are becoming less and less because the process is very expensive. And since it's not covered, it's hard to maintain. I can't speak for every country, but you can see that the range is very broad between the situations of the different stool banks.
Lovely. Maria, I think that brings us probably to the conclusion. Any final take-home messages for our listeners?
Yes, I would say that in conclusion, if you have a multiply recurrent CDI patient, you are really doing this person something good if you find an FMC center for that person, because they are really desperate most of the time, and they will be very grateful if you support them in doing that. And concerning all other indications, I think it's not the time yet, but I'm very optimistic that we will get there in further indications soon.
Thanks so much for your time, Maria, for your time and effort sitting down this Friday afternoon. Thanks, everyone, and goodbye.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues.